Welcome to the Business of Health podcast, your go-to resource for practical insights on managing employee benefits and lowering healthcare costs. I'm your host, Mike Martins, and together we'll uncover strategies to enhance price stability and optimize your company's health benefits. Let's dive into the world of healthcare economics and tackle the challenges of the business of health. Well, I want to thank everybody for jumping on today to catch yet another episode of Business of Health. We've got a solid guest today, and we got a solid topic because we're talking about direct primary care. And this is not our first show, and it will not be our last show on direct primary care, because it's something that at First Staff Benefits, we fully support. We think that it is a system that needs to be evaluated, certainly by every employer that has the opportunity to utilize it. I want to welcome today my guest, Dr. Jack Forbush, who is up in the very corner of the beautiful state of Maine. And he just told me that it is starting to get fallish, if that's a word, get fallish up there. So for those of us that are still in the triple digits, just hang in there. It's going to get better. It's going to get better. Dr. Forbush, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation. We're into the fall weather air texture, and it's currently raining. So I am trying to dry out a little bit after being come in from outside.
let me tell you, I think there's a lot of people listening today that would do just about anything to get that rain that you're having. So it's all good.
Oh, but undoubtedly.
Let's kick this off, because I want to... Not only do I want to focus on your experience in direct primary care, but I also want to talk about the Direct Primary Care Alliance and the New England Direct Primary Care Alliance, because this is something that is certainly not new, but it's gaining momentum and it needs to gain more momentum. I don't want to assume that everybody that's listening today knows what direct primary care is. So let's start with a quick definition of that, and then tell us a little bit about your background and how you moved into this concept.
Sure. So direct primary care is, well, there's the philosophical reason why a lot of doctors go into it, which is to return to taking care of patients rather than, you know, working for insurance companies per se. But it really comes down to a direct financial model between the patient and the physician/physician office in such a way that members, patients, I should say, pay an ongoing subscription fee. Most of the time it's monthly, or in some situations there might be an annual discount, if you will, quote unquote, by someone else's, that a patient, family, et cetera, would pay to that physician for the services that they provide. Now, once you've seen one direct primary care practice, you've seen one direct primary care practice, to quote Fialescu, but nonetheless, it's because there are several different nuances to that, primarily driven by the type of practice that the direct primary care physician may have. So for example, I provide obstetrical care and hospital care. So there's a different model of practice than, say, another direct primary care practice that does not provide obstetrical care. So there are always little nuances, but at the heart of it, it's a direct financial model between the patient and the physician. And that often includes, somewhat dependent upon state law, the provision of significant cost savings with medications, lab testing, and other diagnostic testing. So it is a very cost-effective way for the patients to receive their primary care, and as well as many of the ancillary services, lab testing, x-ray imaging, et cetera, as mentioned. But that's kind of the nuts and bolts encapsulation of it. It would be important to point out that direct primary care is often fused with concierge medicine, which the primary distinction between that, and I'm certainly no expert, but I'll share my knowledge. Concierge is essentially insurance-based practice plus a retainer fee. So the physician would still bill the third-party payer, but there is some old subscription fee or executive retainer, so on and so forth, to cover the costs that for services that are not included as part of a contract. With direct primary care, there was no insurance involvement whatsoever. Nothing. I don't submit a claim to the third party payer. And along with that, that's part of how we're able to provide very high quality, very cost effective care to patients. And that often includes synchronous offline management, whether it's, you know, email or texting services, et cetera.
Well, and I think there is absolutely no question that patients, by and large, are frustrated with the, and we'll call it the standard system, of being involved in a situation where physicians are not readily accessible at times, number one. At number two, wait times can be excessive, and time spent with the patient a lot of times really becomes limited because they're under the gun to see 20 or 30 or 35 people a day. Right. And the direct primary care concept to me makes all the sense in the world, because what we have seen that this, and we're going to talk about the state of group health insurance in a minute, but what we've seen transpire is this system has moved to a situation that I equate to auto and homeowners insurance. Your auto carrier is not going to put new tires and new batteries and fresh oil in your car. Your homeowners insurance is not going to paint your house. And we're now in this world where if I have a group health plan, and maybe it's a quote unquote good group health plan, I still have deductibles. I still have coinsurance. So if I don't have an event in the period of a year that goes beyond routine well care, and I've got a sore throat and I need a stitch in my hand, I really don't have any coverage. And those barriers are dropped in this concept because the accessibility is there. And let's talk about that for just a second. In your practice, doctor, if I were a member, and I'm going to use the term member, is that fair?
Right. That's okay. Perfectly acceptable.
Okay. Yeah. If I was a member of your DPC practice and I just didn't feel good today, and I called and I said, Dr. Forbush, I'm running a low grade fever and my head's plugged up. You know, should I come in and be seen? How would that process be handled?
Well, sure. That's actually a really good example. And one of the things I really enjoy mentioning most frequently, because it typically associated with the shock value by the people that hear my response. So my response from the staff would be, well, let's, you know, they'll obviously get some more information and they may provide some recommendations of what to do. But at some point during that conversation, it's going to be, what time can you be here today?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Would 10 o'clock work for you, or do you want to come in after lunch?
Yeah.
Okay. Or, well, if you don't feel that well, do you want to do want us to do a video visit with you? Or do you want us to just, you know, so it's very patient centric. And I think my response speaks to nearly all of the direct primary care practices, where it's, sure, what time can you be here today? You know, more than happy to see you at 2 o'clock, or if you'd like to come in at 3, or you need to catch a cab or whatever. So the time from appointment request to appointment arranging is very quick. Let's put it that way.
And I think that is one of the things that is so appealing. You know, when I think about implementing, as an insurance consultant, implementing a direct primary care concept into a group, as an example, this is all positive with virtually zero learning curve. And I use that term because, unfortunately, what a lot of people in my industry do year over year is they try and reinvent a broken product. And they're doing that to try and hold down on the cost to the employee, hold down on the cost to the employer. And when you introduce this concept, what transpires is the employers are like, what? What do you mean? I have access. Mm-hmm. I have access to this person. If I pick up the phone, I'm not going to be told, oh, well, he's with patients. Let me connect you with the nurse. And the nurse says, well, let me see if I can get a hold of him today, and I'll call you back, which may or may not happen. And I'm not trying to be detrimental to the traditional system. Don't misunderstand my concept here. I'm sharing what most patients go through from that standpoint. Right. So it's one of those things that just does not have a learning curve. It's taking it back to the way that it used to be and it should still be today. Let's pick on the insurance industry for a little bit, because I love doing that. I think it's a broken industry. And I think there are a lot of problems, and I don't think there's a simple answer. I don't even know there's a complex answer, doctor. But did your move into direct primary care come as a result of being an innovator or being frustrated?
Probably a combination of both. So I think primarily what drove me to do something different, I'll start with that, because I've been doing this about, 10 plus years. What drove me to do something different is what I'll start with. And that is, that was driven primarily out of sheer frustration with not being able to do the things that I went to medical school for, i.e. take care of patients, and spending an unreasonable amount of time trying to get permission from some third party entity for fairly straightforward things. For example, refilling a pressure medication. Oh, well, that's not on our preferred medication list, so you need to fill out a prior authorization for this and spend all this time, whether it's 5 minutes or an hour, and nothing is ever 5 minutes with the third party insurance industry, to get authorization to refill a medication that you have already been on for an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. So that those sort of things, or even to receive authorization from an unknown nebulous entity to facilitate a referral consultation or testing for things that I determined were clinically appropriate and indicated, to then get permission from someone who's not a doctor, who's never examined the patient, to say, okay, sure, you can do those things. So that real frustration of spending more time with that duty than I was able to provide care for patients reached such a zenith that I frankly was ready to quit medicine and go to work at Walmart as a greeter. I was so dismayed and burnt out and et cetera, that I was literally done with being a doctor. Completely. And now at the time, there wasn't the knowledge of something different. So many of us across the country, and I think I'm sure you've spoken with some, almost like a renaissance period where without even knowing each other, we conceptualized a different model of providing medical care. And I'm sure you've heard from other folks that have called it, similar to Sam's Club or the gym membership or the Netflix or the whatever. And it's interesting that we all kind of came across that idea without even ever talking to each other and not really knowing about it. And so when I put my direct primary care model together, which is pretty much what everyone else ended up doing, because we were all thinking the same thing, I just wanted to do something different and something that would enable me to, to provide the medical care that I wanted to and that patients deserved. So there was no blueprint. And really just kind of, I hate to say shooting from the hip, but shooting from the hip and saying, if I want to keep being a doctor, I got to do something different. And here's a hunch and let's see how this works out. And fortunately, when you start doing that and you start learning about doing something different, you start connecting with people and you get ideas and you talk to this person like, oh my gosh, they're kind of doing what I was thinking about doing. Mm-hmm. So it was really neat. So then that turned in that kind of flourish from I'm sick and tired of this slavery into really becoming much more of an innovator kind of the canary in the coal mine, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah. What were some of the roadblocks being the innovator, and innovation is the mother of invention. So what were some of the roadblocks that you came into when that light bulb came on and you said, this is a better way?
Well, one of the, I wouldn't necessarily call it a roadblock, but I would certainly call it prompting you to think differently is, I wonder what would happen if I called a wholesale pharmacy and said, I wanted to buy medication from you. Because what other doctor does that?
Yeah.
Unless you're you're doing some type of infusion in a rheumatology office, that's not something that you learn in medical school about.
Sure.
You call up a wholesale pharmacy and say, I want to buy some medications for me, or even for that matter, I wonder what would happen if I called my lab and said, I want to essentially buy lab testing from you directly. So the roadblock really had more to do with no one's ever really asked this question before. So we don't really know how this is going to work. So let's see what we can figure out. So there's that part. And then there's the whole part of, I learned to be a doctor, but I never really learned to run a business. But when you stop and think about it, you say, wait a minute, I buy groceries, I pay my mortgage, I pay my monthly bills. It's probably not that much harder than that. Okay. I have $10 and I'm going to spend six to keep four aside. So some of that, just thinking differently about how to run a medical practice, because previously, and I converted my practice from the typical third-party model, wrapping the head around, I'm not going to have to wait 30, 60, or 90 days to actually be paid. This is actually kind of neat. And I don't have to be concerned about hiring 25 million staff people to go after the claims, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then I guess other real mental light bulb was, holy mackerel, I cannot believe how inexpensive these things can be. I have students in the office all the time, and I will say, how much do you think the cost of XYZ blood pressure medication is? And they'll rattle off something because they've never been asked that question before, and they kind of go onto GoodRx or some other prescription savings card. And I said, well, that's that. You think that's a good price? Well, that's a great price. Well, what if I told you it was 2 cents a pill? And then they said, it can't be 2 cents a pill. It can be, and it is. And here's my invoice showing you this 2 cents a pill, you know, or you know, how much do you think this blood test costs? Oh, that's going to be $100. No, it's five.
Yeah.
So it's, I wouldn't so much call them roadblocks as more of this like almost spontaneous epiphany about, which then I will freely admit is only made things more frustrating that
sure.
I can't believe that we have this system, which is entirely based upon feeding itself and these backroom kind of smoke and mirrors, colluding arrangements. When if you get that, you get those players out of the game, you kind of say to yourself, wow, you mean to tell me I can take care of someone's high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, heart disease, et cetera, for a couple hundred dollars a year? Like,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's almost unbelievable. So initially you're like, this is too good to be true. So you take a chance and you find out, holy mackerel, this is amazing. You know, it's amazing when I call up the local X-ray center and I say, I want a reasonable price for an X-ray. And they say, how's $50? I'll take it.
Yes.
You know, I'll take it.
Yes.
This is great. This is actually fantastic. So you're telling me I can get this for $50 without even negotiating. Them
right.
Just saying, how does this prep? And when they find out you're going to pay us today. Yeah, I'll pay you today. Oh, so, you know, that, which is really, it's no different than a lot of the most other business practices, yet not really germane to the provision of medical care, because we are used to, you submit the claim to XYZ third-party insurance, you got the codes and you got the resubmission, you get the fighting back and forth, et cetera. And so you've got this massive mammoth of administrative nonsense. When you eliminate that, it's just enlightening.
Well,
and absolutely enlightening. Yeah.
I don't think any other industry in this country could stay in business having to go through and jump through all of the hoops that the medical community that operates in a traditional insurance environment has to go through. There, if you own a construction, well, construction's not a good example.
Your car example is great. So let's say you took your car into the shop and the mechanic said, okay, I need to contact State Farm to see what tires are on their preferred tire list.
Yeah.
And what type of motor oil is on their preferred list. And okay, so it's really Pennzoil, but you've always used Valvoline. So I have to submit an authorization in order for you to get the Pennzoil. And even though you've always used Goodyear, Goodyear is not on their list of preferred tires. So we're going to submit an authorization. And then when we hear back in a week or 10 days, we'll be able to put the Goodyears on. And
yeah.
So then you would say, well, what am I supposed to do in the meantime? Well, you could hitchhike, maybe catch an Uber, you know, wait for the tires to come in.
I mean, that
would be so grossly unacceptable.
Of course.
It's become forever. It was the norm, if you will, for healthcare. And
Well, and you know, that ties back to the point, if you can even get approval for the Goodyear tires. So and then on top of that, the next comment is, okay, we got your approval. Your Goodyear tires are X number of dollars. And your comment is, well, but I can go down the street and buy them off the rack for 60% of that. Oh, well, you know, so it's convoluted mess at best. And I know this isn't the specific order that things happen in, but once you got all of your ducks in a row and you said, okay, you woke up one morning and you said, okay, I'm ready to go.
Yep.
What challenges did you have in the community with saying, hey, I'm over here and I'm doing something entirely different and you ought to pay attention?
Well, so I will tell you, one of the best marketing things that occurred when I first started doing this was all of the negative marketing press from those that were threatened by this model.
I can't imagine that.
So, you know, the local hospital, and the fun, frustrating part is, it's the very people that I worked with that were all of a sudden calling me, oh, you're cherry picking patients. You're catering to the elite. You're going to be refusing people care. This is not a successful model. Private practice is dead. No one's doing this before. You're going to come back. You're just going to fall on your face. So that in and of itself, all that negative, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's an idiot and he's a terrible doctor and he's got a wart on the end of his nose and he needs a bucket of Tic Tacs and he can hardly speak English. You know, all that stuff caused a lot of folks to say, it sounds like he's bucking the system a bit. I should at least listen to what he has to say. And of course, ironically, the very population that they thought I was going to be catering to is the exact opposite population our patients are overwhelmingly blue collar. The fella down the road has got a family, can't afford the Cadillac insurance, just trying to take good care of the kids or the teacher down the road or whatever. And they don't have any. We estimate between 75 and 80% of our patients have no insurance coverage whatsoever.
Interesting point.
Whatsoever.
Because that was one of the things that I wanted to ask you, because although we certainly are told, and I keep saying I'm not going to pick on, I'm picking on people.
I pick on them all the time. Don't worry about it.
We're certainly told that the number of uninsureds in this country is dramatically dropping. Thank you to the Affordable Care Act and the state and federal exchanges. No, I don't think so, because we do a lot of work in industries that have typically lower wage employees. Many of them have episodic employment. And they do not participate in the group health insurance plan. Very few of them actually participate in exchange-based programs, even with subsidies or premium tax credits, because they're still facing a deductible that they can't finance. So to be able to have a reasonable monthly fee that you know is going to take care of the majority of the issues that are going to happen to us, it makes all the sense in the world to me. One other quick question, then I want to jump into the alliance because I want to make sure we have time to talk about that.
Sure.
One point that I think has got to be made here is we are beginning to see a trend of more and more employers moving to some level of self-funding on their group health insurance plan. Lots of different models there. We won't get into why they do or don't work because that's a whole nother show, but it's an interesting one. Second part of that is anything that occurs in a direct primary care office, if your group medical plan is self-funded, never touches your claims pool.
Exactly.
And I certainly understand that a cancer diagnosis or things that are catastrophic, one of those can take away several years of good utilization at the primary care level. But at the same time, you cannot forget that diagnostics are key here. And what we all know and we all understand is a lot of things, if they're caught in an early stage, can be treated inexpensively.
Even with those high ticket items, let's use the cancer, for example. You know, a partnership with this model, this direct primary care model, let's say you are my patient and you are unfortunately diagnosed with a cancer. That's a very high ticket item. You're going to be undergoing very expensive treatment. Even in light of that, the cost savings that this model provides you and the employer with ancillary testing, such as lab testing, maybe even some cases medication, that's an enormous cost shift out of that otherwise globally high ticket item. So you need to have your blood count done, come in. It's like $3. Okay. Every time you have to get a blood count, it's $3 or $4. So if there's let's say it's $50 for the blood count. But if every time you need that done, I'm able to save the employer $47.
Yeah.
That goes a long way.
Of course it does. Of course it does. And again, these are all items that never touch that claims account because no one's filing anything. Let's shift gears real quick and talk about the alliance. Let's talk about the Direct Primary Care Alliance and the New England Alliance. Share with me what's going on there, Doctor.
Sure. So I'll take you a little bit of an encapsulated history in that how these organizations really grew was, I'll talk about the New England group to begin with, because actually it started out as a main group and then extended. We really wanted to provide an avenue to get more physicians doing direct primary care and serve as resources, as educational advocacy, some kind of, you know, people in arms sort of thing. And really saw that as we did that, almost like you're kind of doubling your penny every day in a way. So we wanted to create a local, regional, and national group of physicians, like-minded individuals, to support other physicians going into this direct primary care model. When I started doing this a number of years ago, it didn't have a name, so we kind of bantered around, and we all kind of just sort of settled on this nomenclature, moniker of DPC, direct primary care. But our heart was really, and our intent was really to provide some resources to get more people into doing this, get more educational material, provide, as I mentioned, some brothers and sisters in arms, serve as resources, templates, et cetera, to show that this is not only a successful model, but it's a thriving model. And we are achieving that with each passing day. Just in the state of Maine, we've gone from, 9 or 10 years ago, we had 3 people in the state of Maine doing it. Now we're close to 30.
Wow.
Okay. So you start out with 100 nationwide, and pretty soon you're at 500 and wondering, holy mackerel, I think we might have something here. You know, I think we might have something. So over that time, our support, our educational offerings has really continued to blossom to the point that we are now at a position where we can begin offering other services to practices beyond, you know, just educational, whether it's, you know, certain group purchasing power, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, folks like Dr. Purcell, I may have mentioned in our email, has really been able to reach out in his area to the local employer base. And certainly the same thing is true for me, because it is becoming more and more on the minds, on the heart and minds of employers.
Yes.
And I think not quite exponential, but pretty darn close to it, where employers they're getting pinched from a variety of areas financially. They want to do right by their employees, pardon me. They want to retain those employees. They want their employees to have good access to healthcare. They want to do right by them. And this is proving to be, let me give you this example. So one of my employers is a general contracting agency. He's got a handful of employees. So below that, you know, where he's really able to provide anything, you know, significant for coverage, had a young lady, I'm not sure if it was a ladder or piece of drywall or whatever, fell on her shoulder, dislocated her shoulder. So calls me up and says, what can you do? I said, well, on your way over, okay, have her stop and get an x-ray, $49, have her seen in the office, reduce the shoulder in the office, get a follow-up x-ray. The entire cost was the membership plus the cost of the x-ray.
Wow. Well, and
so that's, when you compare that to, you know, a several thousand dollar ER visit, you know, with no follow-up, that's a significant savings.
Well,
it's a significant access to care. Yeah,
exactly. And you brought up a point that I want to come back to for just a second. Employers, regardless of industry, they are all struggling to recruit and retain, every single one of them. And from the standpoint of being able to implement a service like this, that is a high touch piece, a very, very high touch piece. We've covered the savings, but from a cultural perspective, if you want to provide them something that is going to create value, it's the DPC situation. Dr. Forbush, we're unfortunately running out of time. I would love to keep going. What have I forgotten? Is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't covered?
The only thing I would say is I would encourage your listeners to really this is not intended to be anything against the insurance industry, the brokers, et cetera, but just to really encourage them to think a bit outside the box with regards to the coverage offerings they offer to their employees, because it is a win-win for the business and it's a win-win for the employee. And I know employers want their employees to be taken care of and they want to have good touch points and they want to have all those things. I think this is, as this becomes more and more, the awareness increases, if you will. It would not take much for the employer to just look in their general area and say, holy mackerel, I had no idea I had three direct primary care practices three blocks from me.
Yep.
Because we are out there. The Direct Primary Care Alliance has a directory and a map that they can plug in their address. And the New England group has the same thing to see the practices that are in their area. And I think they would be pleasantly pleased at the growth and the availability to their business and to their employees.
There's no heavy lifting to get involved.
No, not at all.
I super appreciate you being on the show. One of the things that always comes up, and I know it will after this episode, is why didn't you ask this? Or I would like to know more about that. How do the listeners get a hold of you, Dr. Forbush?
Sure. Well, they can certainly, the respective websites are dpcalliance.org. And for the New England, it's nedpca.org, which stands for the New England Direct Primary Care Alliance.org. Certainly, they can reach out to me personally through my business website, ocfm.com, and all the contact information for the respective groups are on there. I think they'll be pleasantly pleased at how interested we are to have conversations with them, whether it's at a high level or even on an individual level. We are certainly willing to do what we can to provide education and provide outreach and to provide support.
Really appreciate the information. Appreciate you being on the show. Thanks again and have a good one.
You too. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Well, the only bad news today is that we're at the end of the show. So thanks for listening to the Business of Health podcast. Listening to this show puts your agency in position for success. Remember to click the link below, check out my website at www.firststaffbenefits.com. Give me a shout. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Keep listening, keep learning, and keep taking action. Until next time, this is Mike Martins signing off.